This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. Woods Hole is home to 5 world-class scientific research centers. 3 of them have hired new presidents in the last year, marking a major moment of change in this small but vaunted science town. Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, Marine Biological Laboratory, and Woods Hole Research Center all have new chiefs, and they're all dealing with similar pressures. The federal government is getting more tight-fisted with funding, private fundraising is getting more competitive, and now they're even battling computer hackers from overseas. Today, we meet the new leaders for the first time and ask them about the future of science at their institutions. We start with Mark Abbott, the new director of Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. Since 2001, he's been the dean of the College of Earth, Ocean, and Atmospheric Sciences at Oregon State University in Corvallis. He's also served on the National Science Board, which is the body that oversees the National Science Foundation. Mark Abbott, welcome to Living Lab.
Thank you very much, Heather. Pleasure to be here.
Okay, Mark, we recently, a couple of years ago, sent one of Woods Hole's most beloved research vessels, the Oceanus, through the Panama Canal and up to Oregon State. Now you've moved out here. Did we get a fair trade?
Well, I think the answer is still out there, but I hope so. I think you did.
Why did you want to come to Woods Hole?
It is the premier oceanographic research and engineering institution in the world. And since we don't know of any other planets that have oceans and research, it's probably the best one in the universe.
I like that assessment. So tell us a little bit about your research and how that prepares you to lead an institution like Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution.
So starting at UC Davis, University of California, Davis, I had a PhD in ecology, and so I was always interested in the intersection between biology and physics, the environment, and the organisms that live in there. That led to research on satellite oceanography at Scripps Institution of Oceanography, that is using satellites to study the Earth and its oceans. And that's really at the heart and soul of what Woods Hole does. It's really understanding the ocean and its role in the Earth system.
Let's talk a little bit about the kind of research that goes on here. And we've seen a real shift in funding sources and the way you go about getting funding. And that can translate into the kind of research that happens. Woods Hole has always been really or Woods Hole Oceanographic has really always been a basic research place for the most part. Do you see that changing at all, moving more into maybe applied science, looking for patents, looking for ways to market the products of the oceanographics research at all?
Well, actually, I think if you were to look at oceanography, it's always been in service of some larger need. And I think, you know, its history was with the U.S. Navy, and we weren't in the actual implementation, so you can't say we were doing products or providing direct services, but our fundamental understanding of the ocean helped the Navy do its job. That's changed, obviously, over the last 50 years, where the National Science Foundation, National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and NASA have all gotten interested in the Earth and its components, atmosphere, land, and ocean. I think that's always going to be at our core, that's in our DNA, is to do that fundamental understanding. And yes, we do work that has direct applicability, but I don't see us moving into really sort of the short-term patent business development. Those will be spin-offs, but the primary heart, the sort of 80% core, is going to be understanding the ocean, how it's changing, and its impact on our planet.
The Navy, as you said, government funding, one of the major sources of funding for the oceanographic historically. And in recent years, we've seen some significant cuts to federal funding in this area. Earth science, environmental science, particularly targeted for cuts by legislators who do not ascribe to mainstream climate science. How much of a threat is that to the oceanographic's stability and well-being?
Well, it's always challenging, but I would argue it always has been, maybe more challenging now than it has been in the past. But I think part of it is we just have not done a particularly good job of articulating how the sort of changes in the ocean affect people's ability to live on the coastlines, gather fish from the sea, all sorts of things like this. So, for example, we've had fairly persistent drought in the West Coast. A lot of that is thought to be the result of changes in the ocean, warmer waters, changes in the circulation patterns. Those issues, that concern about are we seeing more persistent drought or more intense and longer fire seasons really transcend a lot of the political boundaries. And I think that's an issue where we can begin to really articulate how knowledge really can help us understand and make better investments, better business decisions, better policy decisions, and get around this, in some sense, roadblock of climate change, non-climate change.
In terms of funding sources, private funders, whether that's industry or foundations, have become perhaps a bigger part of the pie as we've seen the federal dollars shrinking. How do you see that playing out at the Oceanographic?
Well, I think that's one of the reasons I actually came to the Oceanographic. They have a fairly large non-government source of revenue. Why is that important? It doesn't replace the government funding, but what it does is allow us to do things at the edge, the high risk, the unknown, the interdisciplinary science that's sometimes harder to fund through the traditional federal agencies because the competition is so intense. And the Oceanographic has a long history of using those funds to support a lot of innovative research, things that are just hard for NSF to fund because they say, well, that looks really high risk. We're not sure whether it's going to work or not.
Does that raise any concerns for you or your scientists about, particularly if you're working with industry, about conflicts of interest or even the perception of a conflict of interest?
So that's a different question. I think we were looking at private sources in terms of more the philanthropic side, but working with the private sector, with corporations, you can pick out, you know, oil companies or fishing industry or chemical or what have you. I think the key issue there is, one, it has to be very clear that this is all open science, open data, open access. It's not behind the scenes. It's open to the community, just like all of our government data. I think you have to have really clear conflict of interest policies in place. But I think the fundamental issue is that we are not working for those companies. We are doing fundamental research, and they're interested in those results. No different than the U.S. Navy.
How different are some of these funding issues and major trends in research playing out in a university setting where you are coming from versus here in Woods Hole, where we're not an independent degree granting, it's not an independent degree granting university. It's purely research and it's entirely, you know, grant funded or whatever. There's not that teaching salary there for scientists.
Well, you know, the Oceanographic does have the joint program in oceanography with MIT, and that is really a crown jewel in the Oceanographic world. The best students come here and graduate from that program. But you're right, it is a smaller source, but it does keep the best scientists coming into the field. However, I think the other issue that attracted me to the Oceanographic is its focus on ocean research and engineering, its independence from all of the pressures that are pulling universities down all sorts of different directions. Now, you go to any university and they worry about undergraduate education. They have to worry about the football team, perhaps. They have keep the alumni happy. There are all sorts of other issues that they're good, but they can distract from the fundamental mission for an organization like the Oceanographic, where research is our heart and soul.
You mentioned engineering, and you also used this phrase earlier, science for the greater good or for a greater purpose. There's some internal workings that help determine what kind of research really goes forward. And when a scientist gets a grant, there is also a sum of money that goes directly to the institution for things like maintenance fees.
Mm-hmm.
The way that the Oceanographic has gotten that money in the past has tended to favor projects that were very heavy on engineering, creating instruments or gear that might serve the broader community as well. And that system is being overhauled a bit. Do you see that emphasis changing away from that engineering?
Well, oceanography is a science that really depends on the advances in our ability to observe the ocean. New tools, be it satellites or gliders or fluorometers or oxygen sensors, all of those have opened up this environment that, you know, we can't live in, we can't see through. And the ability to observe the ocean has really, it leads to revolution in our understanding of the ocean. And so engineering really is a full partner with the science, because the science and its advances depend on our ability to withstand the salinity and high pressure environment that we find in the ocean. And those new tools just open it up And so I don't see that as a really fundamental change, but it's something, again, that makes the Oceanographic a unique organization because it's always had a strong engineering side as well as a strong science side. And those work together hand in hand.
Now, I imagine this is like asking you to pick your favorite child, but are there some projects going on at the Oceanographic right now that have you particularly excited?
Well, so just starting to get to learn that. So I've been meeting with all of the departments, learning about their science and their interests. I think there are at least a couple that I would, in my 2 weeks on the job, say that I'm interested in. I'm very interested in a lot of the robotics efforts and how these, what are sometimes called autonomous vehicles, the ability to put together a suite of instruments on a vehicle that can go out and sense the ocean to follow jellyfish around or understand the changes in the Gulf Stream or in coastal ocean circulation. That ability to deploy lots of different sensors out there, it expands the reach of our ships and our submarines. I think that's really exciting, and the Oceanographic is really a world leader in those vehicles. Another thing that and it's sort of a soft spot because I'm an ecologist, is there's a lot of work on mathematical ecology and modeling. That is taking ecosystems, the relationship between the phytoplankton, the, you know, at the base of the food web, the bacteria, viruses, adding in zooplankton and fish and understanding their interrelationships and how those relationships are transformed by changes in the physical environment. So we know the world ocean is changing, and so understanding how those ecosystems are organized is going to be really an important tool to have in the future.
You mentioned your excitement about robotics, and of course there's this persistent question in ocean science as well as in space science. Do you use the robots, get more bang for your buck, or do you pour the money in to actually put human beings, their eyes and their bodies and their brains down there at the bottom of the ocean to see things firsthand?
Right.
Where do you fall on that?
I don't think it's an either or, so I'll sound like a good administrator. Alvin and its capabilities of putting someone who's there who has the insight and the immediate ability to look at something and say, wow, let's go over here and look at that and to deploy. We're a long ways from being able to recreate that inside robots. Now, on the other side, robots can go for places people can't. They can be out there for longer. And so it's not an either or, it's a both. And I think that, you know, I've been involved on the Space Studies Board as part of the National Academy of Sciences, and we've asked this issue about human exploration versus robots. But I think you can clearly see robots are getting more and more capable and are able to do more and more. But right now, not able to replace people, certainly not in the ocean.
From my own experience, having talked to a number of oceanographic scientists, you have scientists on your staff who fall firmly into the robotics category or firmly into the human exploration category. You have climate scientists, mathematical modelers, molecular biologists. It's a huge diversity. What holds everyone at the Oceanographic together, and what role do you play in trying to create some cohesion?
So it's an enormously talented group, and I think our first job of sort of the administration side is to make sure each individual can succeed in his or her science. And that's all from the administrative tools to the funding, et cetera. But I think the larger issue for the institution is, can we provide a vision that's broad enough so that everybody feels like I'm part of a larger whole? I see how my science fits, and I'm moving the whole community forward. And so there's a little bit of a push-pull. We're not creating that vision, but we're enabling that vision, making them feel like they're more than just a collection of individual storefronts in a very large shopping mall, but something that's moving a community of science forward, a community of scholars. And that's really job one, is to enable those interactions to take place and to foster them.
I want to ask you about a recent incident at the Oceanographic. You had to shut down your computer network for several hours to deal with hackers. You know, this is something obviously not exclusive to the Oceanographic. In fact, computer hacking was a major area of tension and discussion between President Obama and President Xi Jinping of China in September. So what are they after? Why is the Oceanographic a target for hackers?
Well, I think first, a lot of universities are. We've seen it. You can just read the headlines. You see biomedical research or computer research. I think we are at the forefront. And so if you want to get access to the best technology, we would be an obvious place to go for that.
So actually trying to get perhaps plans for those vehicles?
Well, a lot of that is offline, so it's safe and secure. They were not after credit card numbers or employee personal information or anything like that. We don't know what they were all after. We have some indications that they were interested in some of our physical oceanography and some of our ocean engineering capabilities. What those details are, there's a lot of research still going on, and in some sense, we may never know what all that they were after.
Dealing with that in your first 2 weeks on the job, maybe a little bit of a trial by fire?
It was sporting.
Mark Abbott is the new president of Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. He took the reins on October 1st. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Heather.
Up next, we talk to the new presidents of the Marine Biological Laboratory and the Woods Hole Research Center. That's coming up on Living Lab after a short break. This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. Over the past year, three of Woods Hole's flagship research centers have hired new leaders. Today, we're getting to know them. We started with Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, and now it's MBL's turn. Huntington Willard is president and director of the Marine Biological Laboratory. Before coming to Woods Hole, he served as vice chancellor for genome sciences at Duke University Medical Center and founding director of the Duke Institute for Genome Sciences and Policy. Huntington Willard, welcome to Living Lab.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
Now, you grew up in Belmont, Massachusetts, went to Harvard as an undergrad, and then you've worked all over the country and even in Canada. Does this feel like a bit of a homecoming?
I would answer yes until I found winter. That really reminded me I was coming home last year. But yes, it is.
And last winter was a particularly brutal reminder of what winter can be.
Indeed.
I understand that in addition to your role as president and director, you also have a faculty appointment with the University of Chicago in the Department of Human Genetics. Will you continue to have your own research group?
No, I made that decision some time ago, that shortly before coming to Woods Hole, that the contributions that I thought I could make were best if I was leading larger groups of individuals in their efforts. I had had my shot for three decades running my own research group, and I'm very proud of the people who were trained coming through my laboratory and are now set up in their own programs, both in the United States and, as you said, in Canada. So this is a time for another adventure and a very different kind of a challenge, but one that I'm very much enjoying and looking forward to.
How much contact had you had with MBL before coming here?
To be honest, I mean, as you know, in New England, there are people growing up in Boston who are lake people and look north, and there are, there's ocean people who look south, and we were one of those lake families. So I spent most of my time going north rather than towards the Cape. Always knew the MBL was here, had been down here for a few meetings at the National Academy of Sciences just up the road. So I certainly was aware of it, and I'm delighted to be here.
But certainly a really new venture for you.
Very much so, and very much allowing me to get back to my original intellectual roots as a biologist, just thinking about biology and the fascination of biology and what we can learn from it. And that, of course, is exactly what MBL was founded to do 127 years ago.
In 2003, you founded the Duke Institute for Genome Sciences and Policy. That was the same year, actually, that the Human Genome Project was declared complete. What was your vision for that center?
So that was a very different time, but also quite similar in the sense that it was a moment of tremendous biological discovery. For the first time, allowing us to look at the genetic code for not just the human species, but for any species, and use that as a point of departure, a leaping off point, if you will, for finding out not only the biology, the details of the biology that we understood or thought we understood, but more interestingly, from my vantage point, new biology, things we couldn't possibly have even imagined, peering into a black box and trying to figure out what nature was trying to tell us. So that, for me, was the fascination of it. But particularly in the case of the human genome, every time a new discovery was made, we were very quickly going to run into the kinds of societal and social issues that needed to be dealt with, both on a personal level and for the communities around us. So the bold thought that we had at Duke was to bring those two together and to do the scientific discovery simultaneously with and adjacent to those who immediately had to think about what the implications might be for those findings.
Do you feel that those kinds of ethical and societal issues have been dealt with, or are those things that we are still continuing to wrestle with?
We were, not surprisingly, I think, terribly naive, both about how much new science would appear, as well as how to grapple with the societal and personal questions that would come up. So I think we, both at Duke and in the broader field in general, have done a good job in teeing up those questions. One could argue that in 2003, 2005, 2007, it was almost too early. We could tee up the questions, we could put them on a list, but we really had no idea how to really grapple with them.
Science hadn't quite gotten there yet,
right,
to really let it play
there,
out.
And the way we think about it. People just couldn't wrap their head around some of the issues that were coming up. And yet now, with now a decade of thinking and rethinking some of those issues, we're probably in a much better position now to deal with those. But I say that knowing full well that there'll be other questions that no one could possibly have anticipated a decade ago that'll come up a decade from now. That's the nature of science and its impact on the world that we live in.
You mentioned the broad naivete about how much new science would be produced and its impact. I don't think those in the Human Genome Project ever actually said this, but somehow the story as it went through, you know, the game of telephone through the media and out into the public seemed to get translated into something to the effect of, we're going to sequence the human genome and within 10 years we will have cured all diseases. Was the Human Genome Project oversold? Has it lived up to the expectations, at least of the scientific community, if not the general public?
So those are two different halves to the question, and I'm going to separate those. So I don't think it was oversold. I think, in fact, if you ignored what you said about the timeline, that in fact the Human Genome Project has done spectacularly well and will continue to do spectacularly well in informing us about ourselves as a species, where we came from, where we're going. And yes, indeed, that will have an enormous impact on both the precision and the ability to translate that into findings in healthcare and in medicine.
Can you give an example of something that has? I mean, it's a short timeline for science to say, you know, 10 or so years later, but are there examples at this point of major breakthroughs, major understanding in human conditions that have come from the Human Genome Project?
I think so, and the timeline is short. The average, if you look at it going back over the past 50 years of biomedical research advances, it often takes an average of 17 to 20 years for any research discovery to find its way into the clinic. So it's actually quite dramatic that there are some that within a decade were finding a place in hospital care and healthcare. The most obvious example is in cancer. The recognition and the ability to have the tools to begin to look at individual cancers and treat them as individual cancers. I mean, we've always said in medical education, we have said, oncologists have said it, if you've met one case of cancer, you've met one case of cancer. And you have to. So it really was the perfect case where you might be able to look in and expect to find and develop tools where you could react to what a particular individual had and how one should approach, manage that condition, hopefully treat that condition, and prevent its recurrence. So cancer is the best example of that. Every cancer, every tumor has unique genomes that are different from every other patient with that same disorder. So it really is tailor-made for that approach.
When you're at MBL, there's a much broader swath of biological sciences that you're now leading. What's applicable from what you've been doing at Duke and in the area of genome sciences and this policy that you bring to leading the MBL now?
Yeah, that's a great question. And in fact, many of my colleagues asked it a little less politely than you put it. Were asking me, what was I doing? A career human geneticist by training and working on human genome and suddenly going to a place that works on everything except human for most of the time. And my answer was always the same, that the last time I checked, every organism that we study has a genome. And if we didn't understand the human genome very well, good heavens, imagine the discoveries that we can make by uncovering genomes from the host of other organisms and species, most of which we don't even know anything about, and we haven't found them enough in order to label them new species. I mean, the estimates are that the largest proportion of undiscovered species lie in the oceans. And in fact, those are both opportunities, sort of cauldrons for discovery of new biology, new pathways that I can't even articulate because by definition, we don't know them yet. But also as the sort of canaries in the mine, the sentinels that tell us something about ocean health and climate change more generally, and that will begin to tell us, as they already are, where we're finding differences and stresses and strains in the ecosystems.
When you're working in human genetics, even if your goal is not to solve some health problem, you're really only a step or two away from that potential application of your research. Here at the Marine Biological Laboratory, you know, working on ocean microbes or squid or all of these other things, there's maybe a case that could be made for some application of that research, but a lot of it is just basic curiosity-driven research, especially in this day and age with such restricted science funding. How important is that basic research and how do you make that case?
Yeah. Well, so I would push back. I would push back on a couple of different things you just said. First of all, I think even in the human, studying the human as an organism, the number of dots that one has to connect looking forward to translate that into, quote, useful, unquote, discoveries is actually very, very long. We can often state it much more crisply than that and make it sound like it's just around the corner, but the reality is very different. One of the things that is easier to do with other organisms than it is to do in the human is to do a phrase that I often use with my students, which is to freely confess our ignorance. And we don't like to do that very much when we talk about ourselves. And yet it is the rest of biology, the rest of nature invites us to do that. And we should be clear, the MBL has always been, and I think always should remain, a fundamental biology discovery institution. We are delighted when our discoveries can make an impact on the world around us, but in reality, we don't understand the world at all. And so we need institutions, and the MBL is very proud to be one of those that is focused on fundamental biology discoveries for discovery's sake, driven by the curiosity to find what we don't yet know, and yet make the best of those in order to tell us the both about the past and the future of nature and its organisms. So that is our fundamental center of gravity. And yes, we like to connect it to what we know about the world, but the science of climate change is what drives us. We're aware of the policy implications of it, but what drives us is the science of climate change, to understand what's happening, to understand the impact on organisms, and understand how organisms, from their genome to their behavior, do in fact react to a changing environment and the threat that's around them all the time.
A few years ago, it became public knowledge that the MBL was facing significant financial problems, a large operating deficit. How much better off is the MBL today than it was a few years ago?
So our connection to the University of Chicago has been a spectacular lifeline, but much more than a lifeline. It's given us an intellectual community of colleagues who are superb, both at the university itself and with its other affiliates like the Argonne National Laboratory and even the Fermi Institute. Those opportunities allow us to think in a much more expansive and forward-looking way than the MBL could when it was struggling, as you alluded to. So whereas our bottom line may or may not have changed terribly much in a very short period of time, I think the outlook has changed enormously. What that has bought us is the ability to look a decade ahead, to think a decade or two ahead in terms of what the scientific opportunities are, what the educational opportunities are, and how we want to be distinctive. Survival is no longer our goal. Sustainability is a goal, and having a dramatic and unique impact on the biology and research and education around the world for decades and decades to come.
You already alluded to the fact that one of MBL's historic strengths is collaboration, bringing people from very different backgrounds together, especially during the summer when there are so many people here. And actually, there's a recently established award system to actually fund collaboration explicitly between MBL, the University of Chicago, and Argonne National Lab, as you just mentioned. What is the need for that direct funding for collaboration that's not being met by other funding streams within science?
So it is, as you say, it's a difficult funding landscape in biological and biomedical science right now. And most scientists love to collaborate because they find the intellectual complementarity, reaching out, if I can confess my ignorance to you and you can confess your ignorance back, we can find something that we can teach each other and do something better together than we could possibly have done separately. But you're right, very few places are funding that at the very earliest stages. So we need to catalyze that and give people the license, if you will, to enter into a discussion about a collaboration that they otherwise might be inclined to say in difficult times, as we have in this country and around the world for research, to say, boy, I'm really too busy now. I've got to take care of these other lines of activity that I already have funding for. I can't think of something new. So we're trying to provide that catalyst, if you will, both with the research programs and research awards that we now have and others that we hope to be developing in the future as we attract our own funding around our strategic plan and the launch of the new age or a new age for the MBL. I mean, the MBL is so old that you, in fact, can have a new age every 25 years. So I have to be careful of calling it the new age, but it is the next new age for the MBL. And our most obvious and some of our most committed colleagues and collaborations will come from people in Chicago and Argonne because they already are it's sort of like when you marry into a family. There's no guarantee that those are going to be your best friends, but you might as well spend a lot of time and effort because there's a shared commitment to do things together. And so far, that's been working beautifully, and I'm sure it'll continue to in the years ahead.
Huntington Willard is president and director of the Marine Biological Laboratory. Hunt, thank you.
Thank you.
Last but not least, the new president and executive director of Woods Hole Research Center on that organization's role in addressing the scientific and social challenges of climate change. That's coming up after a short break. Stay with us. Welcome back to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. Today, we're meeting the new presidents of the big three scientific institutions in Woods Hole. Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, Marine Biological Laboratory, and the Woods Hole Research Center all hired new leaders this year. Joining me now is Phil Duffy, the new president of the Woods Hole Research Center. He's a physicist who served for 3 years in the White House as a senior advisor to the U.S. Global Change Research Program and as a senior policy analyst on science and technology policy before coming to Woods Hole. Phil Duffy, welcome to Living Lab.
Thank you.
Phil, you have a PhD in applied physics. You've published studies on atomic and astrophysics. You actually worked in the weapons research program at Lawrence Livermore National Lab. But in the past 20 years, much of your focus has been on climate change. So what happened? What made that quick change?
Yeah, my second job out of graduate school actually involved detonating nuclear weapons in the Nevada test site, believe it or not. So what changed? Well, I knew I didn't want to do that for the rest of my life, and I also realized that a nuclear test ban was imminent. And I had an interest in climate science, which actually originated with my mom, of all things. And my mom was an academic climate researcher at Brown University at that time. And I remember when I was in graduate school getting interested, well, just talking to her about the science and getting interested in it, and she studied paleoclimate and ice ages. And so I had been looking for an opportunity to get into that area. And actually, one of the things that's nice about the big, I was at, as you mentioned, a weapons lab, but it's really a multidisciplinary laboratory. And they have...
Yeah, there's a lot that goes on at those national
There's
labs.
A lot that goes on, and they have a very good climate change program. And I managed to get myself into that program. And I worked in that program for, close to 20 years.
In 2003, you founded a collaborative research program at the University of California looking at the societal impacts of climate change. What are societal impacts? How separate are they from things like sea level rise or erosion that we might talk about?
Well, I was always interested in understanding how climate change affects society. And what that means is the term societal impacts refers to looking at questions like how does climate change affect water scarcity? How does it affect species? How does it affect agriculture? How does it affect, in short, the things that we really care about? But the idea was that we had really good capabilities for doing climate simulation, but not so good capabilities in terms of understanding these societal impacts issues that I just described. But the idea was that that expertise resided at the university campuses, and if we could bring these folks together, we could power, in a powerful way, address those issues.
one of the keys to getting at those societal impacts is something technically called downscaling. This is one of your areas of expertise, basically taking this big global picture and trying to look at what that might mean on a local level. That's still one of the hardest things to do. How much progress have we made?
Well, some. You know, and what I was doing at that time is I was trying to run, I was running global climate models on what was literally the fastest computers in the world, which Livermore Lab had for doing nuclear weapons simulations. And the idea that was we wanted to be able to do simulations that were detailed enough so that we could address these issues that I described, like water scarcity and agriculture and so on. And I'll say, you know, it was a really fun and challenging period. And we, you know, we used these computers that were, you know, as big as your house or bigger and consumed as much energy as a small city, you know. And recently I looked and you can buy a computer that's almost that fast now at the Apple store for $4,000. I think at the time these things cost $100 million, you know.
So we've made progress on the actual computing hardware.
The hardware has always progressed a lot faster than either the computing software or the scientific knowledge.
So that we still have a lot of work to do in that area. I mean, how certain are we of the impacts when we start getting to local or regional levels?
Well, there's some things we know and some things we know less well. And a lot of what we know is because we can see things in observations that are happening already. And when we see things in observations that are happening already, and when that's consistent with what the models tell us should be happening, that gives us a level of credibility.
Is extreme weather part of that?
Extreme weather is part of that. And certainly many regions of the world, we see increases in different forms of extreme weather. Extreme heat, very commonly, extreme precipitation. Hurricanes are a little tougher because we don't have good long data records for hurricanes. In order to detect trends and changes, you really need records that go over decades. And for things like heat and temperature and for things like precipitation, we have those in a lot of places. Hurricanes less so, because before the satellite era, a lot of hurricanes were simply never detected because they didn't make landfall.
In terms of extreme weather, I think this is one of the hardest messages for journalists to try to convey from scientists to the public and do it accurately. You actually spent a few years at a group called Climate Central where scientists and journalists are really working side by side. What was that experience like?
Well, it was interesting. I learned a lot about public attitudes about climate change and what they are and why they are what they are. And I think all of us were at the beginning of that process pretty naive about that. And one thing I learned is that the public actually understands that climate change is real and understands that humans are causing it a lot more than you might think. There are differences across political parties, but there's a lot of acceptance of those basic realities across all political parties and age groups. The other thing I think I realized at that time is that a lot of the questioning of the science of climate change is really sort of a proxy conversation in the sense that I think what people really are uncomfortable with is not so much the science, but what they're worried, what they fear that the solution will be, what they fear that the policy remedy will be. And they worried that a policy remedy will inhibit their lifestyle and inhibit their ability to have freedom and be prosperous.
Speaking of policy, you went from Climate Central to the White House Office of Science, Technology, and Policy.
Yep.
The names of the people and the credentials of the people in that office, always amazing. But I mean, it looks like a grown-up scientist sandbox. What's it like to work there?
That's a hard question. I mean, it's an incredible experience. It can be really, really difficult. It can be really, really fun. It can be the best job you ever had. It can be the worst job you ever had, depending on the day. It's extremely demanding. You know, I'm happy to have had the opportunity to work for John Holdren, who by the way, was a former president of, or is a former president of Woods Hole Research Center. John is an incredibly smart guy and a member of the Falmouth community who works incredibly hard, and he's also incredibly demanding. And when you work for him, you really got to do your best work. So work, and but it's great to be in the White House, and you meet, and you're exposed to just an amazing array of issues and people. But at the same time, you know, you have to accept the fact that you're a cog in a machine. You know, it happens to be the most powerful machine in the world. But some folks who come there think that they're going to have more latitude and independence in terms of influencing things than actually turns out to be the case.
What drew you to Woods Hole Research Center?
What drove me to Woods Hole Research Center is, first of all, it's a first-class scientific place. The scientists and the work that we do are just absolutely top quality, and that's really important to me. But the other thing that is very appealing to me about the place is that we try to, and we do have societal relevance. We do involve ourselves in policy processes, and the specific work that we do has real societal relevance. And this goes back to, I've always been interested in doing science problems that have societal relevance, that can help address some of the really important societal challenges. And so, you know, for me, it was tremendously appealing to come to the Woods Hole Research Center, and I love it every day because the work that we do really is on the front lines and is really super relevant.
Well, the Woods Hole Research Center was actually ranked as the number one climate change think tank, has been 2 years in a row now, by the International Center for Climate Governance.
Right.
This is a relatively small staff.
Yeah.
In a historic building here in Woods Hole, what gives it that distinction and that clout?
It's a combination of the two factors I just said. It's, you know, that ranking is based on the quality of research and on our policy influence. And I should say that ranking is, in the interest of full disclosure, that ranking is sort of a per capita. It's ranking, meaning that we're ranked number one for our size. I think that there are, in that ranking, they have a separate ranking, I think, which in which other institutions come out higher because they're bigger and have more absolute influence, if you will. But still, we're very proud of the fact that if for our size, we are ranked.
I mean, without quibbling about numbers, you're number one, it's an incredibly influential group.
We think that we are, and I'm really proud of the staff for being able to do that 2 years in a row. And I should say, I deserve absolutely no credit for that, since all of that was based on work that was done before I showed up. So it's nice to get that recognition, but it's really the staff that deserves it.
Of course, the staff is doing the work, but leadership is also important. And Woods Hole Research Center has been in a period of transition, really. I mean, two interim directors in 3 years, and now you're coming in. What are some of your goals for the center?
Well, one thing I really want to do is we've talked about our policy influence and our involvement in policy processes, and we are involved in policy processes at all level, meaning international, national level processes, to some extent in the U.S., to some extent in other countries. But the policy involvement is one area that I would like to expand, and that is one of my strategic goals for the center, is to expand the work that we do in the area of climate policy. I mean, right now we're doing well, but it's frankly, it's a little bit haphazard, in the sense that it's, our policy involvement is based on personal connections that the scientists might have, that I might have, and we'd like to make that a little more systematic. We're actually looking to try to hire someone to be a policy director, but we don't have funding to do that. We're looking for funding to hire a policy director, and we'd like to do that.
Woods Hole Research Center will have a delegation going to the climate negotiations in Paris this December.
We will.
What are you hoping might come out of those talks?
Well, I got to be honest, you know, I have never been I'm not a huge fan of that process. I think it's proven to be a useful process. But I think the original idea with that process is that we were going to get a binding agreement among 195 countries. And as we all know, that hasn't happened.
That has proven extremely difficult.
I don't think it's going to happen. But what's interesting is I've now, and I think a lot of folks have now, come to the opinion that it doesn't need to happen. And one of the things that's so interesting and I think unexpected in the world of climate change is the extent to which the problem is being addressed on what you might call a bottom-up level. That is, individual countries and also subnational groups, cities, states, are making commitments to reduce greenhouse gas emissions without being part of an overall binding international agreement. And I should say that, you know, one of the things that we did last year, the administration did last year, was a joint announcement with China where we together announced pledges for reducing future greenhouse gas emissions. Right. And I think that was a tremendously important accomplishment because China and the U.S. are the two biggest emitters, and together our emissions are a little over half of global emissions. And so for the two biggest emitters to make serious commitments, and they're not enough to completely solve the problem of climate change, but they're really serious reductions. That's really powerful. And that, by the way, is also part of the UNFCCC process. There's the part of that process called the acronym is INDCs, which stands for...
There's a lot of acronyms in this process.
It stands for Intended Nationally Determined Contributions. And that essentially means...
Basically voluntary commitments.
Voluntary commitments, self-determined by each individual nation. But I don't know the exact numbers, but quite a number of countries have made those commitments. And some of them, frankly, in the case of some countries, those commitments are rather unambitious. But in the case of the U.S., for example, in the case of China, those commitments are ambitious.
A lot of the information coming from the basic science community seems to get more and more dire every
year. It does.
And yet, I feel like I've sensed a shift in the general attitude of people like yourself and climate activists who are saying we are seeing maybe a bit of a shift, that we're seeing more voluntary action, we're seeing more bottom-up action. Mm-hmm. What role, then, does a place like Woods Hole Research Center have if we're seeing more of a bottom-up instead of mm-hmm. a top-down movement? What role does a center like yours play in creating those solutions?
Well, for one thing, we're involved in understanding the science, and that's really important. And I'll give you an example. And one of the problems we work on is thawing of Arctic permafrost. And this is a huge... It's a huge global threat, and yet it's not recognized. And the reason it's a huge global threat is that Arctic permafrost contains a tremendous amount of frozen carbon. And by a tremendous amount, I mean something like twice what's in the atmosphere already.
Wow.
Okay. As many folks know, the Arctic is warming twice as fast as the rest of the planet. As that happens, permafrost starts to thaw. And as permafrost starts to thaw, that material that's been frozen for, in some cases, tens of thousands of years starts to decay, and that emits greenhouse gases, carbon dioxide and methane, and that accelerates global warming. And the concern is that this could be a self-reinforcing cycle and an unstoppable cycle. And so we're involved in two aspects of that problem. One is just understanding the science. Is this threat that I've outlined really real, and at what point does it start to happen? At what point does it become unstoppable? Those are really super important. We've had some exposure recently to high-level folks in State Department and the White House, and we seem to have had some success in focusing their attention on this problem. And you may have heard in at the end of August, the president went to Anchorage and gave a speech about climate change, and he mentioned permafrost, and we were thrilled to hear that.
Phil Duffy is the new president of the Woods Hole Research Center. He's a physicist who previously served as a climate advisor in the White House. Congratulations, best of luck, and thank you for coming in.
Well, thank you. It was nice to be here.
That's our show. Until next week, this is Living Lab. You can always find Living Lab Radio on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab is produced by Elsa Partan and Heather Goldstone. Jenny Junker answers the phones. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Major support for Living Lab is provided by the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment and by the Candida Fund, furthering the values that contribute to a healthy planet. Additional support is provided by Lee McGraw and the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation.